This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Zoe Kazan, is one of the stars of the HBO series The Plot Against America, which is adapted from the Philip Roth novel by David Simon and Ed Burns, who also created the HBO series The Wire. Zoe Kazan was also in the David Simon HBO series The Deuce. She co-starred in the film The Big Sick with Kumail Nanjiani, and she wrote the film Ruby Sparks, in which she starred with her partner, Paul Dano, with whom she wrote the screen adaptation of the Richard Ford novel, Wildlife. She's from a movie family. Her grandfather, Elia Kazan, directed On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. Her parents are both screenwriters. Let's start with a scene from The Plot Against America. The story rewrites a turning point in American history. It's set in 1940 to 42. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has lost the election to Charles Lindbergh, who's considered an American hero because he was the first pilot to fly across the Atlantic. But he's also anti-Semitic, he admires Hitler, and won't enter World War II to fight against Hitler. He's an isolationist. The story focuses on a Jewish family in Newark, New Jersey. Zoe Kazan plays Bess, a wife and mother of two boys. The family is targeted for a Lindbergh administration program to relocate Jews to the so-called heartland under the pretense of helping Jews assimilate and integrate into America. For this family, that would mean relocating to Kentucky. Bess has been trying to convince her husband Herman to join the Jews who've been moving to Canada before it was too late. Although Herman is a passionate Roosevelt supporter and hates Lindbergh, he refuses to leave his own country. But he also refuses to move to Kentucky. Meanwhile, there's an increasing number of attacks on Jews and Jewish stores, and Lindbergh is becoming more fascistic. In this scene, Bess and Herman have been listening to a radio broadcast by Walter Winchell, the famous syndicated gossip columnist who's been mounting a presidential campaign to oppose Lindbergh and has been attacking Lindbergh on his radio show. Bess's husband, Herman, played by Morgan Spector, has decided to write a letter to Winchell to get him to publicly protest the relocation program. Zoe Kazan, as Bess, speaks first.
What are you doing?
I'm going to write to him. Tell him we need him to speak out. And the government telling companies where people of this race, that religion, where they can and can't work? You let them get away with that, what's next? That's how fascism works.
You're sitting there writing to Winchell? Walter Winchell.
Yes, I am.
And you're predicting that these people will stop at nothing once they know what they can get away with. And yet you don't think they can do what they want to the mail?
Come on, Bess, it's one letter.
It's not just one letter. You're also planning to sue the government.
As you said, we have rights.
How can you see what these people are and have so little sense of what they are capable of? We have already had FBI agents harassing us. We have had our children questioned. Let someone else write to Winchell.
Someone else? The next guy?
Yeah. Let the next guy step up.
And I just sit here on my ass, keeping quiet, waiting for the worst to happen.
No, I don't see Shepsy sitting around writing letters waiting for the worst to happen.
Not Canada again.
Yes, Canada.
This is my country.
Not anymore. It is Lindbergh's. It is the Jew haters. It is the America firsters. It is the people who chase children down the street asking questions and then deport their families to Kentucky. It's their country.
And if we run, if we quit, then they win and they do not get to win.
Herman.
We have done nothing wrong.
Zoe Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your performance in The Plot Against America. I just want to start by saying, how are you?
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm all right. I have to say, it seems really small to complain about anything considering what so many people are going through right now. We're doing absolutely fine. We all have our health. I'm staying at my parents' house with my partner and our child right now, so it's a lot to adjust to, but we're really lucky.
So you were on a set in Australia and your partner Paul Dano was on a set in London. Both productions shut down. So now you and your daughter, your young daughter, are living with your parents. So you're in your childhood home now as a mother.
I am. It's strange, I think, especially because we don't know when we're going to go back home to Brooklyn. We've been gone from there because my job started in November. So we've been gone for 6 months now. And we don't know when we're going to go back because, quote unquote, when this is over, I think we have to go back to our respective jobs, or at least that's what I'm assuming right now. But, you know, all of us are living in such a state of not knowing right now. So I think that makes it harder than if I knew, like, okay, I'm going to be living with my parents for 6 weeks or whatever. But there's something wonderful, too, about, I mean, it feels like being inside of a dream or something, like giving my daughter baths in the bathtub that my sister and I used to take our baths in, and talking to you right now, sitting on the floor of my childhood closet where I used to, like, talk on the phone to my boyfriend in high school, you know, so it's very strange.
That's pretty funny. So let's talk about The Plot Against America. Are there parts of the story about living in an America First nation that's becoming very anti-Semitic and increasingly moving toward fascism? Are there parts of that story that resonate for you now? And I should mention, Philip Roth wrote this in, was it 2004?
Yeah, I think that's right, 2003 or 2004. Yeah. I was kind of taken aback at the parallels that are on the page. I thought, like, oh, when people write about this, they're going to think that David Simon was being, like, ham-fisted in making allusions to our current government and our current situation. But the high majority of them are right there on the page. And like you said, what he wrote more than a decade before Trump came to power. So, yes, it feels like scarily prescient in some ways. And then in other ways, he was just looking back at the history of our country. And we had internment camps in this country in World War II, as you know. So I don't know that he was imagining an America that far off from the one that he thought we were living in.
What makes you feel most like Philip Roth was prescient in writing this? What echoes today do you most feel from the story?
Roth cautioned David Simon about drawing too strong a parallel between Trump and Lindbergh, and his cautioning was mostly that Lindbergh had once been a great American hero in a way that Trump never has been, and the extra power that a person like Lindbergh would have because of his position in the cultural imagination. For me, the thing that kind of took my breath away, I guess, is the slow creep that you feel in the book. It's not the man in the high castle. It's not what if fascism was imported into America. It's about what if the magnetic forces at work in our country were just given a little push in one direction? What if a certain kind of intolerance was just given a slight nod from powers on high? Like, what permission would that give the average citizen? And how do people get marginalized in, like, small, insidious ways? I think we're seeing it now even more than when we shot the thing, in ways about, like, the way that Asian Americans are being treated right now with the rise of COVID-19 and our president getting on stage and saying, you know, Chinese virus, you know, things like that. It feels like that is something that could have come straight out of this book.
I really like your character in The Plot Against America and the way you portray her. You know, as we heard, like, your husband in the series wants to take a stand against Lindbergh in a public way, right to Winchell, but you think he's putting the whole family at risk. You've been telling him for a while, like, no, you should really get out of America and move to Canada where you'll be safe. And you're smart, you stand up for what you believe in, but you also know your husband isn't going to listen to you and that you don't really have any power. He's going to do what he wants to do. So I'm interested in the idea of you playing like a strong woman who doesn't really have any power.
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting for me because I think when culturally we talk about, like, a strong woman, that has become sort of shorthand for, like, someone who kicks ass and takes names, right? Like, yeah. And this is not that person. She's, like, making a roast chicken and making sure that her kids' clothes are mended properly when they go to school, you know? But it was really interesting for me to sort of be confronted with this archetype of a mother exactly at a time when I was a new mother myself. My baby was about 6 months old when I started filming. And, you know, it was really complicated for me because my body had sort of become totally at the behest of my child, right? I was breastfeeding and waking up at all hours for her. And like my love was totally funneled toward this new person. And my experience of my body was really different than it had been before. And your body is your tool as an actor. And so it was very confronting to me to like have to enter into that person and find her strength and find her opinions and find how she was a person and not just a mother and a wife. And it really dovetailed for me into a similar sort of like refinding of myself within this new role of mother and making those boundaries in a healthy way. And I do think in a way it allowed me to like to allow motherhood to be a priority for me in a way that didn't feel at odds with a kind of, well, for one thing, like the feminist upbringing I was given and the fact that I want something bigger for myself than just in the domestic sphere.
Are there ways in which the story of the plot against America connects with your family? And I'm thinking here, like your grandfather, Elia Kazan, who is, you know, a great director, Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront. He was called to testify in 1952 before the House Un-American Activities Committee during the communist witch hunting era, the Joe McCarthy era. And he named some names of Hollywood actors. He gave up names. And, you know, he was a Greek immigrant, and he was accused of possibly being un-American. It was the House Un-American Activities Committee. And, of course, in Plot Against America, the Jews are basically considered by President Lindbergh to be un-American, because if they weren't un-American, why would they have to be relocated in order to better assimilate into America?
That's right.
So I'm wondering if you were thinking about connections between the story and your family, specifically your immigrant grandfather or grandparents.
Yeah, grandfather. My grandmother was like a Mayflower American.
Oh, wow.
okay. Yeah. Yeah, of course I was. I think it's a really apt question. And I want to say that I don't normally like answering questions about my grandfather, particularly about his experiences with the HUAC hearings, partially because it happened so long before I was born. And I by no means feel like an expert, partially because it's such a terrible chapter in our country's history. And I feel a morbid fear of getting something wrong or hurting further the victims of those hearings or their families. And also because my family, the large majority of my family, are incredibly private people who have chosen very private lives. And I never want to feel like a spokesperson for them or that I'm betraying their trust or anything of that nature. And that's why it makes me emotional sometimes to talk about it. I think that the parallels are right there. And I couldn't help but think of my own family history. And I mean, frankly, I think I wouldn't be much of an actor if I didn't think about it. You know, it's a strong personal connection to the material. I thought very deeply about my grandparents and their choices and what it must have meant to them to be in that position. And frankly, it helped me, I think, take one step in my like personal maturation and actually playing this role and working on this material sort of helped me take steps into, I think, a more adult viewpoint.
How did playing the role make you take steps to a more adult viewpoint of your grandfather? And what is that viewpoint?
Well, I think what I'm trying to talk about is being able to have love for him and also think critically about his actions. I don't just mean to criticize his actions. I mean to think critically about them. And to let a more complicated reality exist in my mind. You know, I was on set playing scenes with Winona Ryder, who's playing my sister, who my character Bess loves very much and also really believes that her sister is not just betraying their people, but also endangering her family. And, you know, it just allowed me space to explore critical thought and draw those parallels that I think are there to be drawn. And I think it's just, I think probably a more adult viewpoint is one that allows contradiction and allows contradiction to exist without being resolved.
I can't. So you're not seeing your grandfather now in terms of like, he was just your loving grandfather, or he was a bad guy because he named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee. You see his position as being more complicated, more ambiguous, and you're trying to kind of embrace the full 360 degrees of his actions as opposed to just seeing one view or another?
I guess so. I mean, I think it's more complicated than that. But yes, I think that's one way of putting it.
Put it better for me.
I mean, Terry, when I was a little girl, I didn't understand that my grandfather was a famous person. And as I got older, I came to understand sort of that he was a famous director, and watching his movies for the first time with my parents at 10 or 11 or whatever, like that was a lot to take in right there. And then, you know, when I was 15, he received his honorary Oscar, and there was a lot of protest over that, and it was very visible. And classmates were asking me about it at school. And at that point, I had never studied the HUAC trials in school. I knew very little about them. This is really pre-internet in a lot of ways. So, you know, my father, who is always trying to tell me the truth about things, was very, I think, factual with me and level with me about what had happened. I appreciate in retrospect how clear he was with me. But when you see protesters, you know, protesting the grandfather you love, that's a complicated thing to take in and understand as a child, right? And I think as a result, it was for a long time very difficult for me to think critically about it. I think I often thought like, oh, one day I'll be able to think more critically about that, but not now. And I think that over the years, like, I came to a more complicated viewpoint. So it's not like this was like a sudden tearing away of the wool from my eyes or anything. But this is the first time that I allowed myself a lot of time and space to think about it. And like I said, to be going to work every day and working on scenes where using those feelings, those complicated feelings, helped feed the scene. But yeah, I think a complicated rumination was something that I probably needed to do, and I was really grateful to have the opportunity on this.
When you think of the complications of when your grandfather was called before HUAC and asked to name names, he's been so criticized for having given up names. Do you wonder what would have happened to your father and to your grandmother had he not named names and had he either been sent to jail or had his career crushed as a result? Like, what impact would that have had on the family? Do you think about that?
Of course I think about it. I think about it because I think about what happened to the families of the people whose names were named. And I think about it because I think about the untenable position that he was put in. And I think about it because of what he did. I think it's probably the moral thing to do, to consider what would have happened on the other if a different choice had been made. But I also can't imagine, right? Because it's unknown.
Right. I think you're really good at playing period roles. In The Plot Against America, it's the early 1940s. You're very convincing in it. In The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is set in the 1860s or thereabouts, you're very convincing in that too. And it's a whole different style of speaking. It's a much more formal and more distanced way of talking. So I want to play a clip from that film and then ask you about speaking in that period. So you're on a wagon train on the Oregon Trail with your brother Gilbert, except he dies early on and then you're left alone. And you and your brother owe a lot of money to the boy who's been helping you on the wagon train, but your brother didn't leave you any money, and now you're broke and have nothing to pay with. You've started to befriend the younger of the two wagon masters, and in this scene, he's talking to you, and he tells you he has a crackpot idea that might be helpful to you. So here is this scene.
So, your crackpot notion?
Yes. Before I expose it, may I ask something?
Certainly.
What possibilities do you look forward to in Oregon?
I don't quite know. Gilbert knew someone there. A Mr. Vereen who owns an orchard, or maybe more than one orchard, and a cartage company. He was vague about his connection with Mr. Vereen and about his own prospective position. I don't wish to slight my brother's memory, but he could exaggerate the nature of an opportunity. And Mr. Vereen's interest in myself, I fear that may also have been speculative.
I see. So, this is no definite prospect of marriage, no contract.
No.
Well, my idea then is this. And I submit it in respect, Miss Longabaugh. I propose to assume your brother's debt to the hired boy and to ask you to marry me.
And that was Bill Heck with my guest, Zoe Kazan. Can you talk a little bit about trying to figure out how you should sound playing somebody in a wagon train in the 1800s?
When I auditioned for that role, I asked if the Coens had like a specific kind of dialect in mind. And they were like, yeah, from like Ohio-ish. You know, it was very unspecific. So I listened to I think they said Western Ohio, and I tried listening to like news reporters on YouTube from that part of the world to know what that might sound like now. And then I kind of just made some stuff up. But the Coens' language is incredibly specific, and I do think that the language tells you a lot about how the lines should be said.
Do you like speaking in that more formal language of the past?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, Terry, you know, my first roles in New York were all on the stage. I did a lot of like Chekhov and stuff that is more canonical. And that's sort of what I cut my teeth on in school. And, you know, like working on Shakespeare in school taught me so much about how to use my breath and like how to follow a thought to the end of the thought instead of the end of the sentence. And working on that stuff makes you not just a better actor, but it teaches you something about the way people think.
Do you mark your scripts so that you know where you're going to breathe?
Not when I'm working on stuff like this. But I do mark my scripts in terms of like thoughts, like just listening to that. I breathe a lot in the middle of sentences in that little passage that we just listened to. And part of that is that Alice, the character I'm playing, is not used to speaking in public or being asked her opinion on things. And I think the way that I read the language, like, I think she's recalibrating all the time. She's also like a real pleaser. And I think she's taking a lot of her cues off the other person. And she's also a very nervous person. So she's like overcoming her nerves all the time. So she's taking a lot of breaths because she doesn't know how long she's going to be speaking. Like, you know, our brains help us take a breath that's big enough for the thought that we want to have. And I think she doesn't really know how big the thought she wants to have is when she takes her breath.
So your partner, Paul Dano, he's probably like a little bit older than you?
No, he's 9 months younger than me.
Oh, okay. So you're basically the same age, but you've spoken about how your experiences as actors are so different because of gender. Like, he has auditioned for a lot of roles that require gunplay, or at least having a gun, and
right.
You have not. And you're asked to cry a lot in auditions or in roles, and he is not, although I have mm-hmm. seen him cry in roles. So I'd like to hear more about thinking about the gender differences based on your experiences.
Oh, gosh, it's just so different. I mean, look, I think what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years with the rise of the Me Too movement and that movement becoming kind of central in our cultural imagination and Harvey Weinstein going to jail, and that's all great. And I hope that makes a real big permanent change. But I also know that there's like years and years, eons of patriarchal construction that supports itself that will try to undo that work. I think my experiences, especially in my 20s, were so, so very different than those of my male partner that I can't begin to describe, not just in terms of what opportunities were available to us, but also in terms of the way that we were treated on sets. Like, the very casual sexism and sexual harassment that I received, which I'm sure is like nothing compared to what some other women have faced, and especially, you know, women of color. But I would come home and tell Paul about what this producer said to me or whatever, and he'd be like, no, he can't have said that. I'm like, yes, he did. He did. And ask any of my girlfriends who are actresses what they've been through.
Can you give us an example of something that you consider that kind of casual sexism?
Yeah, I had a co-star say to me in the middle of rehearsal once, you would be hot if you gained 10 pounds, in a room in which I was the only woman surrounded by male collaborators.
Being told by somebody, hey, you'd be really hot if you gained 10 pounds, that's a really loaded thing to say to you. That person might not have known you had an eating disorder when you were younger. So
yeah.
to say that is just really, they might have been totally unaware of how problematic that comment was. Have you ever felt like you could say something about like an inappropriate remark or an inappropriate request?
Sure, I think.
I'm not trying to apologize for that.
No,
them,
no, I feel like I have gained more, I feel like I've gained more ability to do so as I've gotten older. And also, frankly, because I need the approval of other people less for both like financial and career reasons, like speaking up for myself and saying I don't feel comfortable doing that, or I'm not going to wear that costume, or whatever it may be. Like, that has definitely gotten easier for me as I've gotten older. But within the last few years, I had a producer send me an email saying, you sure have such a big brain for such a small body. You know, it's stuff like that that I think, well, I bet he's not sending emails like that to my male co-stars. But I didn't say anything because I didn't want to make him uncomfortable, because I still had to go to work for him for the next few months, you know. So, you know, it's complicated. I don't think it's all going to happen in one generation. And, you know, I hope to God that I am setting a good example for my daughter. I know my mother set a good example for me. In fact, I think in some ways my mother felt more comfortable speaking up for herself than I did.
Were you offered roles that you considered to be too cutesy about real serious issues that you felt were just kind of reducing complicated emotions to inadequate comedy?
Yeah, I probably auditioned for a lot of roles that I thought were pretty thinly written, that I thought, like, I'm just going to bring my all to it and I can make this into something. And it was in some ways a very strange experience of feeling like that I was walking into a lot of rooms trying to convince them that I could be someone that they would want to hire, that I could be adorable and I could be lovable and I could be the girl next door. I could be the daughter. I could be the adoring wife. I could have 3 lines where I just say, honey, are you okay? And you know, that's a lot of energy and time, right? Like doing your makeup and your hair and picking out an outfit and taking the C train to the east and to the west side and then walking all the way out to West Side Highway to audition for Law and Order or whatever to play a dead body that they find. Like, that's a complicated period of time in, I think, any actor's life, and it can last a really long time. Yeah, I felt like, wow, I was raised to think that, like, my mind was valuable and that, like, the way I looked didn't matter. And I spent half this day trying to curl my hair and put on lip gloss and put on a push-up bra to go into a room to convince some people that I was good enough to say, you know, this half page of dialogue because I really need to pay my rent. And also maybe this job will take me somewhere, question mark. Like, it's really demoralizing to spend a lot of time like that, especially when, like, you know, there are other things you could do with your brain.
So the real question is, did you get to play a dead body on Law & Order?
No, I didn't even get that job, Terry. No, not pretty enough, not good enough.
You've spoken about in the past how you've dealt with depression through your life. And I think this is, while we're all like isolating and isolated and anxious and worried, it's kind of like a very fertile ground for depression.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if like you're having to deal with depression coming back because of the anxiety and fears surrounding the pandemic. And not being home. I mean, as much as it's great to be with your family, it's always nice to be in your own home, which you're not right now.
Yeah. You know, I'm very lucky in that I feel like my mental health is in pretty good shape right now. But also, frankly, I don't know that I really have time to check in with myself or let myself have a deep awareness of really how I'm doing because, you know, we don't have any child care help right now. My parents are both still working because they're screenwriters, and my partner and I are trying to give each other a few hours a day to write, but we're really, like, you know, with our kid all the time. She's almost 20 months and she's extraordinarily active, and you know, we're really lucky because we normally employ a nanny who gives us time to ourselves, and we're without that right now. So to be totally frank, I don't really know 100% what's going on with me mentally because I'm so tired at the end of the day. I, like, we eat dinner, we clean up, and then we get in bed, I do the crossword puzzle, and I go to sleep.
Can I ask you about the eating disorder and how you were able to get past it? Do you connect that with the depression?
Oh, yeah.
And you said that, you know, the eating disorder wasn't because you wanted to like, look thin. That, because it sounds
you've never been
that preoccupied with how you look with clothes and hair and all of that. So, if it wasn't about like having a certain image of like, you know, fashionably thin and fitting into certain clothes, what do you think it was about?
I mean, I think it was about control and I think it was about limiting what I was feeling, you know, like I was very sad. And I was trying to, I don't know. I have a lot of distance from it now because I think I got lucky in a lot of ways and like I really got better. Like I went to therapy and it worked for me.
So, if the eating disorder was about gaining some kind of control over your body, how does acting relate to that, if at all? Because as an actor, your body is your tool, it's your instrument, and you have to control it and basically make it play a different song than when you're just yourself.
The way that my brain connects it up when you asked that question was that I thought, you know, part of my experience of having an eating disorder was that like, my feelings felt too big for me to handle. And I was trying to like dampen them in some way. And I think that having that experience of my emotions as being like a great ocean that I like cannot always handle, it is one of the reasons that I wanted to be an actor. Having a place to put my feelings has made me a saner person. You know, acting really functions for me in a cathartic way. So maybe it connects up there. Terry, can I ask you a question?
You can try.
So I was listening to your interviews with Philip Roth before talking to you today, just in preparation. And I thought like, oh, you interview so many people in this really intimate way and then they pass and you often like re-air those episodes when they pass. And I thought, oh, it must be such a funny experience for you to have this like intimate sort of touch all these people in this intimate way. And then you're touching like really famous people that people are then like mourning online, but you've had like a one-on-one conversation with all these people. Like, did you have a feeling when Philip Roth passed of like, oh, I know him, I talked to him 7 times, does a person like that still feel like at arm's length to you?
Well, it's a bit of both, because I know like Philip Roth and I were not friends. We never met in person. We just had our interviews. But I really love his writing, and felt like those conversations went really well. I mean, I felt like he was just so interesting. So when he died, I thought, well, I was very sad, and I thought I'll never be able to talk with him again. And I'll never be able to read a new book by him again.
Yeah.
So that, you know, of course, there's still books he's written that I haven't read because his body of work was so large. So, the, you know, that's some comfort. But, but you're right. You know, I'm both at arm's length and yet still feel very connected. And one thing I'll say while we're on the subject of re-airing interviews when somebody died is that this is a really fraught period for our show, in the sense that, you know, more people are dying now because of the epidemic, and we've devoted, 2 or 3 Fridays just to obituaries. There was one Friday when I think we had like 3 obituaries on the show, and that just made me really sad, and, you know, we're bracing for more. And so it makes me feel good that we have the interviews that we can play to help remember somebody whose public life, whose work had such meaning for so many people. So it, you know, makes me proud we can do that, but it just makes me really, really sad.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I find them to be, when someone passes that I really care about and you re-air one of the episodes, it means a lot to me, and it makes a space for me to mourn even though I don't know that person.
Well, that's the thing. Like, we might not really know them, but we know their work, and the work is like a manifestation of some of who they are. So it's easy to feel like we know them, and they gave us the gift of their work. So, you know, there's so much to be grateful for, grateful to them for.
Yeah.
It's a sad time. Let's be honest. There's just so much sadness in the world right now.
There really is. It's really hard to to do all the things that you need to do in a day and have that like a very pressureful storm cloud just hanging over.
And it's like what you were saying before about being kind of grateful that your toddler is so consuming of your time, because it's exhausting, but it's something, you know, something really wonderful and necessary to focus on.
That's right.
Because you can't just sit around all day thinking about how frightening the virus is and all the people who are sick and the people who have died and fears
and
that,
lost,
you know,
their health insurance and lost their jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I wish you and your family, your extended family, I wish them well, continued good health. And thank you for taking some time to talk with us. And I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. And to you, Terry, your work means so much to me.
Zoe Kazan is one of the stars of HBO's 6-part adaptation of Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America. The final episode will be shown tonight.